Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And I'm going to look at the economic boom that America experiences in the two decades after the Second World War. And I'll be looking at Grand Expectations. I've referred to the book a couple of times before by James Patterson, which is a really nice kind of overall guide to everything from the end of the Second World War to Nixon, basically. And he talks in the third chapter about economic booms. And what he has to say falls into a way of looking at things that I've long agreed with, that ultimately it is the huge tectonic shifts in economic growth and also economic stagnation that really make the other aspects of a historical era kind of make sense. Here, James Patterson says, "Economic growth was indeed the most decisive force in the shaping of attitudes and expectations in the post-war era. The prosperity of the period broadened gradually in the late 1940s, accelerated in the 1950s, and soared to unimaginable heights in the 1960s. By then, it was a boom that astonished observers. One economist, writing about the 25 years following World War II, put it simply by saying that this was a quarter of a century of sustained growth at the highest rates in recorded history. Former Prime Minister Edward Heath of Great Britain agreed, observing that the United States at the time was enjoying the greatest prosperity the world has ever known." So, that being the case, it's an absolutely extraordinary period of 2.5 decades in which that was true. Not only was, as the book suggests, there were grand expectations, and ever-increasing expectations from nearly all aspects of American society. Greater expectations of personal wealth, greater expectations of personal freedom, and greater expectations that the next generation would enjoy conditions that were better than the ones that the existing generation had enjoyed. You have this culture shaped by exploding living standards, not just rising but soaring living standards. But you also then have an entire culture, cultural shift, a social and cultural shift, probably ending in the crises that we can see now in American politics, when that growth from the mid-70s onwards, the advent of the neoliberal era, grinds to a halt, or goes actually in many parts of America into reverse in the 1980s and 90s. I've done a couple of podcasts about this kind of transition away from America being an economic surplus nation in terms of manufacturing to being a deficit nation, a net importer as opposed to exporter, and the solution that Paul Volcker eventually comes up with of turning the American economy into a finance-driven economy, essentially. How do you create an economic surplus in a time of manufacturing deficit? Well, you become the world's banker, all the economic activity of the world, or as much of it as possible, could be banked in Wall Street with high interest rates, which unfortunately happened to devastate industry. But that's a different story for a later time. Let's just look at some of the stats here. America had 7% of the world's population in the late 1940s and possessed 42% of the world's income and accounted for 50% of the world's manufacturing output. American workers had produced 57% of the world supply of steel, 47% of the world supply of electricity, 62% of the world supply of oil, 80% of the world supply of automobiles. And the country also had 3/4 of the world's reserves of gold. In 1949, per capita income was $1,450. This was approximately double the standard of living that someone in Great Britain would have enjoyed at the time. I mean, there are obvious reasons for that. Great Britain had emerged a far diminished nation as a result of the war. It had endured bomb damage, nothing compared to the way that Germany had been devastated, but it had incurred bomb damage. It had its empire was immensely weakened, but most significantly, Britain had gone from being a creditor to a debtor nation as a result of two world wars. It's worth clarifying that Great Britain became indebted to the USA in 1914, and it was in 1916 that Britain was eclipsed by the USA as the world's foremost economy. So two world wars had left Britain economically eviscerated. The position that Britain had in the mid-19th century as the world's manufacturing powerhouse and also the world's financial powerhouse was long since gone. In 1945, unemployment was recorded at 1.9% of the civilian workforce, an almost unimaginable low. And of course, this is largely as a result of wartime production and manufacturing. Every economy needs a degree of flexibility within the labour market. They need people moving between jobs, and obviously that requires a level of structural unemployment so that there are actually people to go around. Full employment in Keynesian theory would have all sorts of implications for inflation. So by 1948, there was just under 4% unemployment, and that at that point, this was enough for the successful working of an economy that was expanding. So people that are unemployed, they're not really unemployed for very long because new enterprises are growing at a dramatic rate. One key indicator of American living standards was intake of calories, considering how many people in China, India, Russia, across Asia and across Europe had starved as a result of the conflict of the Second World War, and how malnourished generations of children were, or undernourished in the 40s and 50s. The fact that the average American calorie intake was exceeded 3,000 calories per day, and this was a kind of a varied diet. This was, by the mid-1940s, no small achievement. Much of this prosperity was, of course, built on the elevation and the protection of white American society. Not only had immigrants been marginalised and kept out of America from the 1920s onwards, but of course the prosperity and wealth was unevenly distributed, with black and Latino Americans and other minorities not enjoying the same benefits that white Americans did. In short, America was increasingly prosperous in the 40s and 50s, And that prosperity didn't seem to affect social cohesion and social stability, at least not within the kind of the confines of suburban white America. Perhaps one reason why this is looked back on fondly and nostalgically as a golden age in American life, the era of the white picket fence and suburbia, is because of the end of the Second World War, the returning of GIs from war, and the kind of reabsorption of fighting men into the nuclear family and the patterns of family life, but also because it wasn't the 1930s. The murder rate had halved since the early 1930s, and violent crime that had been a figure of the 1920s, which is the 1920s and the early 30s, had dwindled considerably. There are some demographic explanations for this. The young men who came of age in the late 1940s, who had been born in the late 1920s, were a particularly small kind of cohort of individuals, so there were fewer young men around. These are the prime group for crime and disorder. Obviously, large numbers of them had served overseas. And the situation reverses itself when there is a baby boom, and by the mid-1960s there's a huge generation of young people and an exploding crime rate. So when we look at the difference between the 1940s and 50s on one hand and the 1960s on the other, a conservative with a small c view of the 1960s was that liberalism and drugs and the idea that people can do whatever they want, this had led to everything from Altamont to the Manson family. And that's probably not really a realistic cause of social change on that scale, or criminality, or what have you. It might be that actually the relatively low crime rates of the late 1940s are the aberration, and the processes of kind of urbanisation and dislocation and movement and all these sorts of things are more an indicator of what might be at cause of criminality in the late 1960s. So, as I've said in a number of podcasts in the past, particularly the one I did on segregation and suburbia some time ago, prosperity and affluence and the American dream was determined racially. Those that were going to enjoy this, or far more likely to enjoy this, were going to be white American.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The fondness and nostalgia for the 1940s and 50s is generally a kind of like a white historical memory. There aren't, by and large, a lot of black writers, intellectuals, filmmakers, or anybody else that talk about picket fences and apple pie and mom and pop and all the rest of it. The experience of black and Latino people in the 1940s and other minorities is really quite different. America's poor, whom black and Latino people disproportionately comprised, had a very different experience of the 1940s. There was, during the beginnings of this boom period, 40 million people living below the poverty line. That's one in three Americans. In 1947, a third of American homes had no running water. Two-fifths had no flushing toilets. Three-fifths lacked central heating. Four-fifths were heated by coal or wood. And there was still a majority of the population living in rented accommodation. The home-owning dream for most Americans had yet to happen. There was, for the people who lived below the poverty line, fewer calories to eat than future generations would enjoy. And most still worked in agriculture, in mining, in manufacturing or construction. So the working class life for America's poor is fundamentally different. Some of these would be lifted out of poverty in the coming decades, and it would be those who are lifted out of poverty, both black and white, who would be more inclined to speak of there being an American dream, or there would be more notions of opportunity. But for a lot of Americans who live below the poverty line, the vision of America that was being lauded around the world wasn't one that they personally experienced. There was a dramatic shift between the 40s and 70s towards urbanisation. 24.4 million Americans lived in the countryside or farmed for a living in 1945. That was 17.5% of the population. In the late 40s, there was a shift from farm to town and city that actually engulfs various cities with booming populations. By 1970, there were only 9.7 million Americans living in the countryside, or 4.8% of the overall population actually working the land. The number of farms fell by 5.9 million at the end of World War II to 3 million 25 years later. Life was harder still for the mainly black and Hispanic farm workers who were landless rural labour, who had no stake in property ownership and simply worked on poverty pay in the countryside performing casual labour. Despite the growth in prosperity, one thing that shaped the 40s and 50s and 60s and the generation that had survived the war was the memory of the 1930s. The experience of economic crisis not only left many Americans after the war fearing that there might be a return to the Great Depression, but also a culture of immense prudence and care with money and conservatism when it came to spending and consuming existed. The vivid memories of the Depression, where it was possible to be plunged into homelessness and hunger very easily, meant that, and also the kind of the thrift of the war years, where using every last bit of a chicken carcass or a vegetable patch, or making sure that gasoline was used only for the most important of uses. These two factors mean that this culture kind of continues on into the later 1940s and 1950s. And the early post-war years that had this culture of thrift about them, from families' clothes to the toys children played with to the holidays the family went on, would eventually be swept away by a surge of new consumer choices once the boom years of the 1950s took off, and then the kind of the hyper boom of the 1960s happened. For non-American listeners who are familiar with the term middle class, the development of a middle class, which some historians put down to the Roosevelt era and the kind of the long democratic period from Roosevelt to Johnson, that middle class had distinct characteristics. The middle class that emerges from the late 1940s and 1950s were often simply people who had been working class, who were able to attain home ownership and to achieve a certain degree of stability, security, savings, pensions, and a level of comfort, a kind of sort of consumerist comfort. Poverty was in decline throughout the period. We've talked about that bottom third of the entire population. It remained a significant issue within America, though by 1955, the levels of people living in poverty had fallen to 22%. And in 1973, it had fallen to 11%. So enormous strides had happened in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and then up into the early 70s to lift people out of poverty. Though the rest of the 70s, or the later 70s anyway, 80s, 90s, 2000s, and up to now, have seen that trend go into reverse in certain parts of the USA. One of the key factors that shaped this explosion in economic activity was the American government itself. The war had seen a dramatic expansion, not in just of government, but also of industry and America's industrial capacity. Aircraft, for example, electrical and electronics businesses, chemical giants, food processing, sort of, so tinned foods that had fed the troops and fed half of hungry Europe, tobacco manufacturers, all these vast industrial giants had boomed during the war and weren't about to go anywhere thereafter. There's a really interesting section in Anthony Sampson's brilliant book, The Arms Bazaar. If you ever want to read about the 20th century arms industry, get that. Where the aviation industry in 1945 almost collapses because of the end of war orders, until the American government step in and continue a level of military spending throughout the 40s and 50s, which is roughly consistent with that had happened during the war. So government spending did help this expansion of industry. Federal spending in 1945 was $95.2 billion. And in 1948, that does decline to $36.5 million by 1948. However, the advent of the Korean War in 1950 saw American government spending soar again by $43.1 billion in 1950. The states and the local government across America was a massive source of income and economic activity. In 1948, for example, states across America poured $21.3 billion into building schools, roads, and other infrastructure. And you can only imagine how gratefully received this would be by American businesses. Private investment skyrocketed, research and development skyrocketed in this period because of a thing that I suppose capitalism likes more than anything else, guarantees. The idea, the knowledge that there is an interventionist state there ready to spend money makes it all the more likely that businesses will take the necessary risks to develop and innovate new products, goods and services for the market, which they perceive to be continually buoyant. So I suppose the point here in this first podcast I'm doing on American post-war economic prosperity is that this didn't happen out of the blue. The conditions were there. The success that America had in war and the fact that America was itself untouched by war and the fact that there was this state that had already had experience of powerful economic interventionism in not only the New Deal but also the direction of war and the direction of war industries could use this to stimulate and be what we call, you know, the interventionist state during the 40s and 50s, and this was a powerful contributory factor to the enormous economic boom that we see all the way up to the early 1970s. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Swing by the Patreon page and see what we've got there, some more cool stuff, and if you can sponsor us, that would be great, because obviously the podcast itself needs resources to continue running. Thanks very much, all the best, and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.